Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Here's a fact we all may want to consider as we go through the next hour. Despite this country having more people in prison than any other Western democracy, many, if not most of the people we have behind bars will someday get out of prison. And that's an important fact because once people serve their time and are back on the streets, they become our problem again. Trouble is, people with a criminal record, particularly those with felonies, face enormous obstacles when it comes to getting a job, finding a place to live, getting access to health care, and taking a responsible place in the civic life of communities. And perhaps that is why in North Carolina, 35% of offenders are rearrested within 1 year of their release, and 47% are rearrested after two. This costs taxpayers money, and it makes our communities less safe. So is there anything being done to change this? Well, the short answer is yes, and we'll take a long look at those efforts and at whatever success they may be having this hour. Myra Clark is Executive Director of the Center for Community Transitions. That's a nonprofit helping people with criminal records and their families to find healthier, more productive ways of living. Their motto is building people, not prisons. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Good to see you. One way the center helps people improve their lives after prison is to put them to work and to work with other organizations such as SocialServe, which helps find housing for these folks and is also a second opportunity or second chance employer. And Tara Peel is executive director of that organization here in Charlotte. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Mike.
Good to see you. And Eric Ortega is program director at LifeWorks, which provides individuals with criminal records resources and tools they need to reach both personal and professional goals. Thank you for coming back.
Thank you for having me.
And all three of them are here in our Spirit Square studio. Joining us by phone is Adam Gelb. He is director of the Public Safety Performance Project with the Pew Charitable Trusts. They help states put policies into practice that protect public safety while also reducing recidivism. Thank you for being here as well, Adam. I'm sorry, Adam, I have to turn you on. Thank you for being here. I'll give you a chance
to
respond.
Great to be with you this morning.
Great. If you would like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. You can also watch the four of us in our studio. You have to imagine Adam, but you can watch us on Facebook Live. The three of the people here around this table in the studio work every day with people who have committed a crime and who have gotten out of prison and who are trying now to reorient themselves to civilian life. All of these people face the challenges that I talked about in the opening a moment ago when it comes to trying to reorient themselves or reintegrate themselves into society. But give us an idea of the scope of what we're talking about. How many individuals are we talking about in Charlotte alone? I'll start with you, Myra.
Coming out of the state system, we have about, I think it's close to 1,300 every year come back to the community. Mm-hmm. When you look at the jail and the number of people who come through the jail, there's probably 20 to 25,000 people who were released who were processed through the jail every year, maybe a little more than that.
And when you say community, are you talking about the city of Charlotte or are you talking about Mecklenburg County?
Mecklenburg County.
So you're not talking about Gaston County, Catawba County, just no. Mecklenburg County.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a lot? Put that number into perspective. Is that a lot of people?
I think that's a lot of people to come back to this community. And that doesn't count the federal inmates who are coming back to the community. And I have no idea what that number is. I've not been able to get anybody to nail that down to tell
me
what the number is. Yeah.
We don't know. Why don't we know? No one keeps records?
Well, they do keep records. I think there's an estimate somewhere around 800 to 1,000, but I haven't tried recently because couldn't get an answer before.
And LifeWorks is a part of the Center for Community Transitions. How many people do you work with on a regular basis?
So last year alone, we worked with 560 individuals who were either released from jail, Mecklenburg County, or relocated here from other states. They are released from prisons in other states like New York, Florida, and hear about how many opportunities there are in Charlotte and relocate here without a real plan. And then realize when they get here, there's more obstacles and barriers than they thought. So they come to us.
So about 500 people, you said, which is less than half of the people that are released just in North Carolina. And it doesn't. And when you add people coming here from elsewhere, it's an even bigger problem. So what happens to the people who you don't work with?
Well, hopefully they're reaching out to other services in the community. Okay. But many of them are just wandering the streets or looking for help through the Homeless Services Network or other agencies.
So getting out of prison, particularly if you've served time for a felony, puts up significant roadblocks. Historically, people can't find a job, they can't get a job, they can't get housing, they can't get health care. Is this just a problem for felons, or is it anybody who has a record, whether it's a prison record, Tara, or it's a stint for a month or two or three in the county jail?
It's absolutely a problem for people who have felonies and misdemeanors, even charges that were dismissed, to get a job or get housing in Charlotte. For us at SocialServe, we have about a third of our staff have criminal records of some kind. Some are felonies and some are not. Some are minor drug offenses. They themselves have a hard time getting into housing, even though they work for an employer that helps people find housing. So they face barriers to both housing and employment. We seek to take away the barriers to employment by hiring regardless, and we hire intentionally from programs like Center for Community Transitions. In terms of housing, Charlotte is such a competitive environment for housing right now. There's so little affordable housing here that housing providers can be extremely choosy.
And it should be pointed out that your organization not only works with ex-offenders, it also works with the elderly, it works with low-income people who are trying to find affordable housing. And as we've done so many shows on the lack of affordable housing in the city, it is alarming how many people, and it's growing. The number of people needing affordable housing is growing as the number of affordable housing units declines. Is it much more, how when you stack it against the elderly and the poor, how much more difficult is it for people who are getting out of jail or prison to be placed in affordable housing?
I mean, they absolutely compete against a number of people who are low income who don't have criminal records. So they have that disadvantage. We get thousands of calls from around the country every week from people who are looking for housing. And obviously the people who have the lowest incomes have the hardest time finding housing. But when you compound that with the fact that people with records also tend to have low incomes because they can't find stable, well-paid employment, then, you know, it's a double bind for them.
Which gets back to the crux of the problem that Adam Gelb at the Public Safety Performance Project has been working on. And I know that, Adam, you've worked with North Carolina and other states on this. A lot of the obstacles that are faced by these people are codified, aren't they?
They are, Mike. But it's really important, I think, as you start this conversation, to think about how things were. Yes, indeed, there are tons of obstacles today, but there really has been a sea change over time, not only in North Carolina, but across the country, about how we should be dealing with these people. You know, it used to be that the prevailing philosophy was that we should just turn inmates loose at the prison gate with nothing more than a bus ticket and the clothes on their back. And over time, people have realized that actually, if you're serious about public safety, you need to have better strategies, and you need to reduce some of those obstacles or eliminate them entirely, and do a whole series of other things that research has identified that actually works to help people turn their lives around and get back on track.
What's driving this change in attitude? Is it simply the realization we're putting people out on the street with no prospect? What do you expect them to do? And so they commit a crime to find to get enough money to eat, and we put them back in jail, and that costs money. Is that simply what's driving this? A sudden realization that we're being stupid about this?
I don't think there was any epiphanous moment along this. It's been about a 15, 20 year long evolution, I think, in thinking of policymakers and the public alike, that stems from a number of factors. Certainly chief among them is the notion that we've done the experiment. That is, we've tried to build our way to public safety with more brick and mortar, more prisons. We went in this country from having a an imprisonment rate of about 1 in 400 to 1 in 100 adults locked up in this country by 2008. There was this huge explosion of incarceration where we were trying at the federal level and in the states to say, okay, we're going to lock you up and put you away. And I think a lot of people at the time thought, well, that would be the end of it. As you pointed out right at the top of the show, Mike, people do get out. 95%+ people do come back to communities. And I think as that cycle played itself out, even with significant increases in sentence lengths for all types of offenders, violent offenders, property offenders, and drug offenders alike, people started to realize we're really just spinning the wheels of a revolving door here. And even if you significantly increase length of stay, people are still going to be getting out. And the point is that whenever it is that they do get out, we want to make sure that they're less likely to return to crime and drugs.
So I know that you worked with North Carolina. Did they come to you and ask for your help, guidance, and support, or did you come to them and offer it?
The former. It's been really tremendous to see around the country, and this is southern states, conservative states, as well as states like a Massachusetts and an Oregon have, over the past 10 years, raised their hands and said in a bipartisan way and with leadership across all three branches of government, the executive, legislative, and the judicial, have come to Pew and to the Justice Department and to our partners at the Council of State Governments Justice Center and others involved in this justice reinvestment movement and said, we can do better. We think we're locking up too many people. It's costing us way too much, and we think we can squeeze more public safety out of the dollars that we're spending on corrections. And so there was leadership at all levels of government and all branches in North Carolina. And I want to maybe specifically mention here, Mike, the leadership of now Senator Tom Tillis. He was the Speaker of the North Carolina House back in 2010-11 when this effort got underway, and has continued to champion smarter criminal justice strategies in the U.S. Senate.
So, Eric Ortega, when you were here last time, we talked about the fact that you are an ex-offender. You were 19 years old when you committed the crime that landed you in jail for a while. So you have personal experience with this. Aside from the things that I've talked about here, some of the obstacles, what do you think is the biggest obstacle? What was the biggest obstacle you faced personally when you got out?
Well, how much time do you have? I think there's twofold. It's access to resources.
Resources being?
Being housing.
Okay.
Employment. Educational services. And then working with the individual on their thinking. Understand that leaving prison, you leave there with trauma. And that trauma needs to be addressed in a way that's healthy. So that way that individual can be successful.
Describe the trauma. Well, I've never heard anybody say that before. What trauma? The fact that they were locked up with other guys
the inhumane way people are treated in prisons.
Okay.
Understand that you are caged in a cell. Mm-hmm. And there has been a lot of reform. However, we still need more progress towards that. You are separated from your family. You are separated from loved ones. Human needs need affection and care. And in prison systems, especially for the male prison systems, that's not provided. You are to be left on your own. There's no human contact or limited human contact. You're told what to do every day. So when you're released, you experience culture shock. Whereas to someone was telling you, for me, I'll keep it on me statement, for me, I was told what to do, what to eat, what to wear. When you're released, you're supposed to make that decision all on your own without guidance.
And freedom can be a shocking thing.
Oh, it definitely can.
We have to take a break. We'll come back and talk more about this and also about some other things people may not know about people who just get out of jail and what they have to face when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the obstacles people who get out of prison face and how North Carolina and other states are beginning to take a different approach toward helping them reintegrate into society, which reduces recidivism. And we'll talk about the cost of that a little bit later on. But it reduces recidivism. It keeps us safer. Myra Clark is here. She's the executive director for the Center for Community Transitions, an organization that helps in that effort. Eric Ortego works with them as a program director for LifeWorks, which works directly with these folks. Tara Peel is executive director of Social Served, which helps to find housing and employment for people getting out of jail, among other individuals. And Adam Gelb joins us by phone. He's the director of the Public Safety Performance Project at the Pew Charitable Trusts. In addition to criminal records that people carry with them when they get out of jail after having served their time, a lot of these folks, Myra, and I didn't know this, also face debt. They have to pay back court fines. They didn't earn any money in prison, so when they get out, they have to pay back court fines, which can be sometimes onerous. Is that right?
That is correct.
So if you didn't have a job while you were in jail, and you can't get a job when you're out, and you can't pay the fine, what happens?
Well, and that's not the only financial burden. Sometimes when folks get out, they have child support to pay, and they have back child support to pay, and they have restitution to pay. And they may have, many of the folks I've worked with have a lot of charges on their driving record that has to be cleared up. So,
and if you can't get a driver's license, you probably have a tough time getting a job.
Well, employers require two forms of ID at least.
And that's part of the poverty trap. It's nearly 40% nationwide are license suspensions for unpaid fines, child support. And that's taken away somebody's ability to create a living wage.
So if you can't get a job and you can't pay all this, what happens to you?
That's where that old thinking comes into play.
You go back to jail?
Well, you go back to a lifestyle where there was an income, even if it was unhealthy.
Crime.
I think earlier when we were talking, I've never had anybody come to me and say, when I get out of prison, I want to do this again. People who are coming out of prison have the attitude that I don't want to come back to this. I want to be there for my family. I want to support my family. I want to get a job. I want to go to church. I may want to, you know, there's a variety of things. I want to coach my son's basketball team. And when the barrier of employment and the barrier of housing, because families now may have to lose their housing if somebody who's been incarcerated comes to live with them, the barrier...
Because of rules saying a felon can't live in this rental unit.
In this rental unit, correct.
So when you add up things like having to pay court fines, child support, back child support, maybe traffic fines, driver's license fines, when you add that up, what's the average cost? What's the average amount of debt that some of these people face? What's the nut they carry, in other words? You don't know.
I don't know.
Okay.
Because every individual is a different story.
Isn't this something, though, that the Pew Center has been trying to address with states, Adam? Adam?
Exactly. And there has been a real explosion in the past 10, 15, 20 years of knowledge about what actually works to reduce recidivism. And there are some things that we thought were effective and important that we were doing that were not working so well, and then a number of things that we've discovered that work quite well. And there are really five key building blocks here. The first is to make sure that we're actually defining recidivism reduction as a goal of the correction system. It might be a little bit of surprise to some listeners, but certainly back in the 70s and 80s and into the 90s, the idea was really just simply to warehouse people. You're just going to separate them from society and hold them, and whenever it was that you'd release them, they would have learned their lesson and not get back in trouble on the other side. Actually defining the role of corrections agencies, whether that's the prisons or the supervision agencies that monitor people on the other side or both, that was really not affirmatively part of the mission. And still, in some places across the country, it remains a struggle to say, hey, that's what we're supposed to be trying to achieve here. The second piece is to make sure that you're starting to think about and plan for reentry as soon as people enter the prison system. It's not something you wait till the few days or weeks right before somebody leaves to help them come up with a plan. The third piece is to really focus the attention and resources on people right as they do leave in the first weeks and months after they do get out, because that's the period of highest risk where they need help finding housing and employment, as your other guests so ably do there in North Carolina. And then you need to respond to how they're doing with very swift and certain incentives, and that is both negative consequences for when things are going off track, but also, and really importantly, positive rewards for when they're doing what they're supposed to be doing and doing well, staying off drugs and staying employed and incentivizing them that way. And then finally, just you have to measure this stuff to understand how well you're doing.
So, are there states that do this particular? Are there states that do this particularly well that stand out in your mind as being on the right track and could be used as examples to other states?
There are, and I wouldn't exempt North Carolina from this in a number of ways. And North Carolina has had in the last few years a 42% reduction in the number of people revoked to prison, and that is a huge achievement, and certainly among the highest or biggest reductions we've seen across the country. There have been a lot of changes in the way supervision is done in North Carolina, including as part of that Justice Reinvestment Act in 2011, saying that we shouldn't be maxing people out, as the term goes in criminal justice circles. That is, making people serve to the very last day of their sentence and then releasing them to the street without any supervision or support. That there should be a period of about 9 months during which people do get help, and victims from their end of things are able to have somebody who knows where the person is involved in their case and helps smooth that transition back to society. South Carolina, your neighbor, has also done an excellent job. Other states include Oregon and Michigan and Texas, which really kicked off this whole movement back in 2007. That would probably be a good surprise to a number of your listeners as well.
Yeah. Myra.
I just want to say that we probably have here in Charlotte one of the best examples of providing the best transition services for people who are incarcerated back into the community, and that's the Center for Women. And the Center for Women has been a contract prison with the North Carolina Department of Public Safety for now over 30 years. And our recidivism rate is maybe 10%. And when the women leave us, they have taken care of their debt as much as they were able to. They have a job, just like with Tara here, and they continue that employment when they leave. They have some savings if they're able to do that. If they don't have child support and restitution to pay, they are able to get some savings. They get counseling with us. They have community support from volunteers that live here in the Charlotte area. And the facility is operated, because it's within the last 3 years of the women serving their state prison sentence, the facility is operated in a much more humanistic and transitional way than a prison is. Because when you walk out of prison, you often are walking from one stark reality to another.
Right.
And the way this facility operates is more of you're in the world and you're in prison. And it really has been extremely beneficial.
Which is the bigger problem for people trying to reenter the workforce, Eric? Is it that employers are reluctant to hire convicted felons? Or is it that these folks got into prison in the first place because they had limited life skills, limited job skills? Which is the bigger problem?
I think today we're looking at more life skills. I think there are more employers open to hiring somebody with a criminal record. It's about now how we work with the individual on keeping that job and conducting themselves in a way that's helpful to not only the employer but the community overall. We see a lot of individuals who can find a job, and they're losing jobs because of maybe their supervisor tells them, hey, you need to improve your productivity, and they're taking that offensively. So we come in and we work with them on those life skills, the workplace life skills that are different from prison life skills, as well as in some cases poverty life skills.
So in other words, if you, I hate to draw broad generalities, but a lot of people get themselves into trouble because they have to pose. They have to look like they're not going to take any crap off of people. And so if you say something that's semi-critical, you have disrespected them, and their natural tendency is to lash out. If that's been your life experience and your boss comes to you and says, you need to improve your productivity, that's their knee-jerk reaction, right?
It's what I call when they get their gangster tested. Uh-huh. When somebody's testing their gangster, they're going to revert back to, without those life skills, they're going to revert back to what's worked for them in the past. And in prison, if somebody tests your gangster, somebody right. challenges you, you have to make sure you challenge back.
Right.
But in the workplace, that doesn't work. So the great thing about what we're doing is we've incorporated curriculum such as Working Smart, which addresses the life skills necessary to be successful in the workplace. So I do think there are more employers today, as such as Tara, that are willing to hire.
Right.
But when the individual starts missing work or they get into conflict with their coworkers, that's when the employer now steps back and says, wait a minute, maybe this wasn't a good idea.
And Tara, you wanted to jump in on this too, I know.
Yeah, I just want to, so working with these programs, Center for Women and Center for Community Transitions, numerous employees we've hired over a period of years from there, and they're often our strongest employees. They want to work, they want to live in the community, and they want to give back. I value my employees. All of them are great employees, but when they go through these life skills trainings, these Work Smart trainings, they have a leg up on reentering the workforce. And yes, we need to be a little bit more flexible maybe in the beginning because they may have to show up to court a few times to straighten some things out. They may get hit with these fees. There's an employee that I have that after several years after the crime, was hit with a $7,000, I believe, fee all of a sudden on a nonprofit wage,
right.
And it's shocking for them, and it may throw them for a loop for a minute, and you let them get through it, and then they come back to work, and they do their job because that's what they want to do. They want to work.
Yeah.
So I guess this is as good a time as any for me to do a call out to employers in Charlotte to give them a chance. These folks want to work, and to property providers. Especially if they have stable employment, and then they get stable housing, you know, that's really the key, that combination.
Talk about landlords. Are the fundamental, the bigger obstacles, what am I trying to say here? The units that will not rent to you if you have a criminal record, are those basically run by large companies, or are they individual people that have apartments to rent or homes to rent that simply don't want that element in their rental property?
Well, there's a mix from small to large landlords. I would say small landlords have a little bit more flexibility, and sometimes they feel a little bit more connected to the issue.
What about Section 8 housing? Do they accept felons?
They can. So property providers have the ability to set their own screening criteria, but they also have a bottom line, and so they have to think about whether the rent that they're going to receive is going to cover their costs. And that means that, you know, is it worth their time to deal with maybe extra red tape? So sometimes they're resistant to accepting Section 8 because of old perceptions. Things have changed with Section 8, and it might be more easy to work with now than they believe. Sometimes they feel like they have to apply the same criteria across the board to everyone who comes in, and they do. Fair housing laws say that they do. So that they don't mistreat any one particular protected class. But, you know, we would hope that they would relax those somewhat because sometimes they're a little overly strict.
Before I go to Adam, Eric, did you want to jump in there too?
Yeah, I wanted to just elaborate on something that Tara mentioned. It's also about educating employers about understanding that when you work with this individual, you're getting probably the most loyal employee you could ever have. And Tara, as mentioned before.
Because you've given them a shot?
You've given them a shot, and you understand some of the barriers that they may face, like going to court. We work with employers now who are understanding, and we've had individuals working in places for 5-6 years and loyal to them because that employer is educated about some of the barriers they face outside of work.
What do you say to convince people to hire these folks or to give them a place to live? How do you convince them that it's not that risky?
Well, this is a big thing here to talk about.
Sure,
this,
sure
but
it is.
But I think I think, one, they're working with an agency, so they've reached out to do the right thing. We know that. The same thing is true for housing or employment. Two, that we will be there to walk beside them as things come up, so feel free to call on us if you need us. It does make the community safer. If people who are coming out of prison have an opportunity to go to work and have a place to live, then the causes of them being in prison in the first place, we're eliminating some of that. It makes the community safer, and it's something we all have to do together. We have to work together to make that opportunity available, because if we do not, then we're pushing people further into criminal behavior to meet the needs of themselves and their family.
What do you tell prospective employers or landlords, housing providers, as they want to be called now? Tara?
I like to bring it down to personal examples. I have dozens, but I'll give you one. One of my long-term employees has at least 10-year-old marijuana possession charge, nothing else since then. One of my most dependable employees, and still has to get his mother to co-sign for him to get an apartment. How long do people have to pay after they've already served their time before they can live their lives like everyone else?
Thank you for saying that. And I think what Adam's doing about sentencing laws is good, but in North Carolina, we need to look at whether or not there's a sunset clause that says after 10 years or 8 years or 5 years or whatever is acceptable. When can we sunset your arrest, your dismissals, your convictions?
I have a minute left in this segment, Adam. How is that a conversation being held in the states that you've been working in about how long a person has to pay restitution or pay for the mistake that they made in their lives that landed them in prison?
It very much is. It has not been over the years, but it is starting to come up more and more, and in fact was part of a package of very comprehensive reforms that was passed in Louisiana just last year, where lawmakers on both sides of the aisle there said that when you do your crime, you should have done your time. You should do your time, and then that should be it. And there were a number of changes that were made that restricted the length of the tails on some of these sentences. And so I think we are starting to see this recognition that if you are serious about public safety, you've got to look at some of the policies that were put into place in the 80s and 90s, where we did think we could build our way out of these problems.
And with that, I have to take a break. We'll come back. I want to talk with you, Adam, about ban the box legislation that's been making rounds around the country as well. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Calling all Charlotte musicians. WFAE is producing a new series, and we want to feature you. Submit your music now at wfae.org/CLT music. Support for this series is provided by Ortho Carolina.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about what happens to people when they get out of prison, how they can overcome some of the barriers that have historically been in their way to make them productive citizens once they've paid for their crime. Myra Clark is here from the Center for Community Transitions. She's been in this business for, I think, 30 years or more.
Thanks for saying that.
You're welcome. Tara Peel is Executive Director of Social Serve. They find housing and employment for these folks. Eric Ortega has been working on this for about two decades as well, Program Director of LifeWorks. And Adam Gelb is here. He's the Director of Public Safety Performance Project for the Pew Charitable Trust. Adam, several states have passed so-called Ban the Box legislation, which bars public employers from, that would be municipalities and governments, from asking about a job applicant's criminal history before an interview. Can they ask during the interview?
Yes, they can. And we actually encourage it. Sorry.
It's okay.
We actually encourage it. We want the employer to be aware of who they're hiring so that way there's safety practices in regards to hiring an individual.
So the point of Ban the Box is then what?
Is to give the opportunity for that individual to not look at the
And the box, by the way, is the little thing that you check off. Have you ever been convicted of a crime?
Yes. Right.
Okay.
When employers see that, they automatically, okay, this person put down yes, let me put this application on the side, let me look at someone else. What we're saying is give the opportunity to that individual look at their skills, their qualifications, and what they're doing now, and then still be responsible and ask them, what were your convictions? So that individual can have an opportunity to explain who they are today, because that's who you're hiring. So Band of Box offers that opportunity for that individual to have a face-on-face with an employer.
Tara.
So as an employer that's a second-chance employer, we don't ask at all. You know, sometimes we know people have criminal backgrounds based on what program they're coming from, but we don't ask them about the nature of the criminal background. We like to interview them and form an opinion on their skill set and their ability to do the job. And some employers may then want to ask about a criminal record after they've already kind of gotten an assessment of how
shouldn't
the person
employers
can do the job.
Know who they're employing? Shouldn't, for the protection of their other employees, shouldn't they know?
I think it depends on what kind of business it is. I mean, if they handle a lot of finances, they may want to consider whether a person has financial crimes in their background. Mm-hmm. We're an employer who does not have that type of service, so we are in a position where we can hire people regardless of background.
So only nine of the 28 states that have these, and I think it's 28 states that have these ban the box laws, extend the prohibition of asking about an applicant's criminal record to private businesses. This is mostly based on municipalities and governments asking these questions or not asking these questions. Are people in the private sector against moving in this direction?
I don't think so. I think, policymakers in state capitals around the country, the attitudes about these issues and the people involved in the criminal justice system are changing. But what I would say, Mike, is that Ban the Box has, I think, helping define a critical juncture in the criminal justice reform movement across the country, and that is that a lot of the reforms, those in places like North Carolina several years ago and Louisiana just last year, have been defined primarily by saying we need to use facts and data and evidence to drive criminal justice policy. We don't want to make these decisions that cost taxpayers billions of dollars when we lock up so many people. We don't want to make those sentencing and corrections decisions based on anecdote and emotion and fear. And what we see with Ban in the Box is now, in the last year or so, a good bit of research coming out that says, actually, Ban in the Box seems to make good common sense, but it also seems to backfire in reality. And that is that, unfortunately, what the research is showing is that many employers, without the advantage of being able to see the box and having that that transparency, if you will, about whether somebody has a felony conviction, are simply looking at the names of people on these job applications and horrifically deciding that, well, this sounds like a black person's name, and I'm going to guess that this person therefore has some kind of criminal record. And we're not talking about small effects here. We're talking about large effects in terms of Ban the Box having a significant depressive effect on the rate at which black applicants are receiving job interviews.
So I was going to ask you if there's a correlation between Ban the Box states and reduction in recidivism rates. What I'm hearing you say is that it's actually exacerbating a problem that already exists.
It may be. I don't believe we have any statewide research yet that would show a correlation between adoption of Ban the Box policy and ultimately what is happening with recidivism rates. But we are starting to see in the research that, at least with respect to job placement rates, that it seems to be hurting.
Are you experiencing this in Charlotte, Myra?
I personally don't see where we're experiencing that here, because particularly for the clients that Eric serves in his program, it's about how you present yourself. And we require our clients to go and see people in person. Don't just fill out an application and expect that to be all there is.
But that's through your program. Do you think, or have you heard of people who don't participate in your program who may be putting in job applications at Burger King or wherever, are being eliminated, not because they necessarily have criminal records, but because it's a low-income job and they may have criminal records, but their name is obviously a black name in that employer's opinion?
I think there was a study done several years ago that was a case overall. The correlation with Ban the Box, I haven't seen the study on it, but I would be interested in seeing the correlation between the name and the states that have Ban the Box. Because what we've experienced in Charlotte, at least, or North Carolina, is beneficial for Ban the Box.
Okay. In June, North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper signed a bill that provides judges with discretion for reducing civil barriers to employment, housing, and other essential opportunities impacting people with criminal records through something called certificates of relief. Are you familiar? You are familiar with
this. Yes, I am.
What is a certificate of relief, and how soon will this new legislation take effect?
Well, I will say that certificates of relief actually started when Beverly Perdue was the governor.
Okay.
And Governor Roy Cooper was the head of the he was the attorney general.
Okay.
And he co-chaired a committee that occurred back then. I think it was like 2010 or something. And so certificates of relief, a person has to go in front of a judge. They have to present the things that they've been doing positively in the community. And they can get a certificate of relief from the judge.
Which does what?
Which, it's almost like they're trying to provide a seal of approval way. But it does not eliminate, and it does not erase what's on your record in any way.
The law does expand the availability of these certificates to people who have been convicted of, quote, no more than three Class H, or is it Class I, or is it Class 1?
I.
Felonies. Yeah. What are Class H, I, and G felonies? What are they?
Well, there's a whole book that has that stuff in it, and there are a lot of different things, so it's very varied. But it's trying to reduce the collateral consequence of incarceration.
And these certificates signal that the holder, quote, deserves serious consideration despite a criminal past. How difficult is that to sell to an employer?
Well, they don't know about it. And so it's really difficult. It's like we need a big media thing or something so people become aware of it.
Here you are.
Here I am. That's right. So, you know, if somebody has this, then they've obviously made positive steps in their life. They've gone in front of a judge. A judge has said they can't erase their past, but they can say, you have given us every indication to think that you're a good risk for anyone who wants to hire you, who wants to rent to you. Who wants to loan you money to buy a car. I mean, just a variety of things.
And if I'm not mistaken, this law will insulate employers from most employment-related negligence claims when hiring or retaining a person with a certificate of relief. Is that to say that if something happens involving this individual, employers then cannot be held responsible by other employees or by their clients or their customers? Or do we know?
To be honest, I don't know that myself. But I will also say that the federal government has a bonding program for people who have criminal records, and that employers can enter into that federal bonding program that gives them some also security in knowing that if something does happen, they are bonded.
Right, which has been around since 1968, actually.
Long time.
So I was going to ask you, Adam, if other states have similar legislation outside of this federal bonding program that they just talked about, these certificates of relief or similar programs where the state actually says, we recommend this person.
I'm not intimately familiar with a whole bunch that do. I think there are some others out there.
Okay. A couple of questions that have come in from listeners. Michael on Facebook, can you ask your panel to comment on the role of private corporate prisons and the capital investment in placing people or keeping them in prison? As you talk about helping people who are getting out find employment and remove the barriers, what about the barriers that get them in there in the first place and keep them in there for a long time? Is that being hurt by the fact that some of these prisons have been privatized and there's a profit motive to all of this?
I think when there's a profit motive, then the expenditure of monies to provide programming and transitional services are low on the totem pole. And I think
Because they want them to come back?
There is a profit motive. But the other part of that is, to me, if you're making money off of another human being, it's another form of human trafficking.
Okay. Stephen on Facebook, does the transition back into society include reestablishing voting rights? What about that? Because felons, convicted felons, to the best of my knowledge, can't vote. So if you want them to have a stake in society, you want them to vote. Well, you want people to vote,
well,
it would seem to me.
Well, individuals who have convicted, you know, who have been convicted of a crime can vote as long as they're no longer under supervision. In the state of North Carolina, you can vote.
Can you vote in the federal election?
Yes.
Okay. Is that the case in most states, Adam?
No, it's not. It's all over the map, though, and there are a lot of eyes on Florida this November, where there's a statewide ballot measure that seeks to return the vote to felons in that state, where they're completely barred.
We talked a minute ago about ban the box when it comes to employers and potential employees. Is there something similar for housing?
There's not at this time. It's exceedingly difficult, and particularly in Charlotte, to get folks into housing who have even a blip on their record. And at this point, I usually like to say many of us have done things that, were we caught, would probably be keeping us out of employment or housing today. Or have someone in our family who have. So I'd like us to take a look at ourselves when we're making a decision about someone and whether they deserve to have a place to live or whether they deserve to have a job that they want, and whether something that they did that they happened to get caught for when we didn't should keep them out.
Claire emails, we own some low-income rental properties, and I'd love to get in touch with agencies that might be helpful in placing folks who need a new home. Can you let me know the names of some of the agencies who help with tenant placement of formerly incarcerated folks at the national level? Tara, I'll throw that to you.
Well, there are agencies all over the country who are helping people who are, I think any homeless service agency is working with some people who have criminal records and trying to find housing for them. At SocialServe, we run a program called Housing CLT, where we work with local homeless services providers to help find landlords willing to accept them into housing. So locally, I sure would like to hear from them, and they can go to housingclt.com for more information about that.
When we talked about this, I think it was about 2 years ago, when both Eric and Myra were here last, you told us that an ex-offender who stays out of prison saves the state about $29,000 a year. Is that figure still relatively accurate?
That's pretty much true, I think, today. And they pay, if they're working and in the community, they're paying taxes.
So is that savings of $29,000 a year the cost of housing an inmate? So there are additional benefits if they're out on the street working, paying taxes, buying groceries, et cetera, paying rent. Mm-hmm. That's more than $29,000 a year.
I would think so. Contributing to the economy in that way, yes.
And that's how people around the country are beginning to see this, Adam?
Sorry, how?
In other words, the savings that we're saving in not incarcerating people, and the fact that if these people who are once now out of prison have a job, are paying rent, are buying groceries and the things you need to live, that it's actually a benefit to society to change our thinking.
Absolutely. And this is part of an overall sense that taxpayers have and voters generally that they want government to produce results, and public safety is turning out to not be an exception to that. There's this notion that no dollar spent on public safety that is spent unwisely. That turns out not to be true. Today, more than ever, taxpayers want their dollars to produce the best possible results for public safety, and we've done extensive polling on this, not only nationally with national samples, but in states as well. And we find that people across the political spectrum, and that includes people in law enforcement households, people in households where there's been a victim of violent crime, large majorities support trading some part of a prison sentence for reinvesting the dollars that would be saved from that shorter prison term into better supervision and services that reduce recidivism.
So in 15 seconds, if we're saving $29,000 a year, What does it cost to do what you do, and could you use some of that $29,000, Myra?
Yes, I could, because there's a lot more to do, a lot more.
Myra Clark, Executive Director of the Center for Community Transitions, Tara Peel, Executive Director of Social Serve, which finds housing and provides second chance of employment opportunities, Eric Ortega with LifeWorks, and Adam Gill, Director of the Public Safety Performance Project for the Pew Charitable Trusts. Thank you all for the hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.